From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what we've learned about the accused conspirators in what prosecutors call a terrorist plot against the governor and other leaders.
Even people who were involved in those protests thought at least some of these guys were out there, even for them, a little too far out there.
Also, one scholar's take on the interplay between Michigan's militia movement and mainstream politics.
They are not just a group of kooks in camouflage. They represent ideas and attitudes that the public more generally has come to hold.
And in other news, relief for families separated by coronavirus as the state begins loosening restrictions on nursing home visits.
I guess at this point, I think that communion with each other is a lot more necessary and significant than any risk that COVID would pose.
One daughter's story and more just ahead. The Detroit Free Press sent out a squad of reporters who spent the weekend driving all over the state to learn more about the 13 men who authorities say were part of the elaborate kidnapping plot against Governor Whitmer, and who also plan to storm and take hostages at the state's capital. M.L. Elric is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the Detroit Free Press who was part of the team investigating over the weekend, and he joins us now. M.L. Elric, welcome to Stateside.
It's great to be with you.
So who were the guys that you were assigned to investigate?
I was asked to look into Adam Fox, who is the alleged ringleader of the plot to kidnap, possibly execute Governor Whitmer, blow up, possibly kill police officers, storm the state capitol, hold some sort of tribunal, and I guess in general, overthrow the tyrants who have asked us to do unreasonable things such as keep our masks on and not cough in each other's face. So Mr. Fox was my assignment, and I wouldn't presume to know everything about him, but after 17 hours and 500 miles, I know a lot more about him than just about anybody else, I'd say.
Can you share a little bit of what you learned?
Sure. And if you want to read our story, you can go to freep.com. We appreciate if people subscribe, because I'll tell you, the overtime bill I'm putting in is not going to be small. But what we found out is that sometime around 2014, Mr. Fox went through a couple things where, in fact, he became Mr. Fox. His birth name was Adam Wagoner. In 2014, he petitioned a court to change his name to his mother's maiden name, which is perhaps apropos of nothing, but certainly not a very common thing. Not too long after that, he got married, but which should be a joyful occasion, but the marriage began to fall apart in less than a year. And the court records that I reviewed showed that he was accused of being drunken, of driving drunk, of smashing property to try and get to his wife to potentially harm her, that he made violent threats, that he likes guns. Nothing wrong with that. But when you're drinking and you're threatening somebody, that can be a concern. Mm-hmm. And in general, that he was someone who may have had some pretty serious anger management issues. And we talk about that and share some of those text messages in my exclusive report for the Free Press.
Yeah. Did you notice any common bonds between the men who were indicted? Anything about their upbringings or their life circumstances?
Some pretty sweet beards was the first thing that jumped out at me.
I thought
this may have been a reboot of Duck Dynasty, but not quite as quaint as those fellers. But I must say I was really focused on Mr. Fox and wasn't able to glean much more about the other people than I read in our big story in Sunday's Free Press. But it does seem that the common denomination is that these are people who are in outstate Michigan, that they tend to live in rural areas, and that there's some, if we're to believe what neighbors told us and what we found in public records, that there's some disaffection with government, that they feel like many people who we're hearing from now, that government has overreached and that it's time for the people to rise up and do something about it. If the FBI is right, what they want to do is rise up in a very violent way and perhaps foment a revolution. But I would suggest that if you're not happy with government, there's probably more productive ways to bring about change.
ML, you mentioned that there were definitely some anger management issues and a bunch of evidence around how Adam Fox handled the breakup with his now ex-wife. Can you give us a sense of whether we're talking about an incident or a pattern of behavior?
Sure. And I should make it clear that these are just allegations, because he didn't respond to the PPO request, the personal protection order request that his wife sought. And he also didn't respond to the divorce filing. So anything that's in that file is just, it's unremarked upon by the defendant, Mr. Fox. But the court, when that happens, basically says, if you don't say it's not true, we're going to assume it's true. And that's the way it goes. But it does seem that for most of their relationship, according to his ex-wife, there was violence, that he was not a pleasant person, that he drank a lot, and that he had some, if not outright violent tendencies, some very unpleasant character traits, and that basically, she says, the marriage ended because of him.
Did you get much of a sense that Adam Fox was part of a more pervasive culture or community? Or is from the folks that you talked to, did you get a sense that he was more of an outlier?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I guess the answer is I don't have that sense, but I couldn't say either way, because the records that I was able to obtain really spoke mainly to his relationship with his loved ones, as opposed to, you know, what he did with the rest of his time. We did speak to the owner of a vacuum cleaner shop in Grand Rapids, where he was living in a basement. It sounds like mainly due to the generosity of the vacuum shop owner, who seemed to have known him for a long time. But other than being someone who didn't seem to have succeeded very well in life, I'm not sure who else he associated with. Our reporting and what the feds have alleged indicate that a lot of the other people he connected with met online, where many people do come together with like minds. But, you know, in terms of if he was a known militia leader, or if he left some sort of screeds for us to read and say, oh yeah, well, this is the point where he thinks he's Guy Fawkes, I didn't run across anything like that. But we covered a lot of ground in a little bit of time, and we're still trying to find out if things like that exist.
The business owner that you referred to is a guy named Brian Titus, and it sounds like he is someone who had conversations and had a relationship with Adam Fox for many, many years, going back to when Fox was just a kid. And this is somebody who had done military service himself. Was there much of a sense of from Bryant Titus about how Adam Fox's life went off the rails?
We didn't get to speak to Mr. Titus in that kind of detail. And in fact, the interview there was done by my colleague, Eric Seals, who's an outstanding photographer and a terrific journalist. And they mainly talked about his thoughts on what the allegations against Mr. Fox are. But it does seem like he was sort of one of those anchors, or one of those rocks that people have in their lives that they can turn to in times of distress or when they're feeling unmoored. But whether or not he saw this coming, my sense from what he told Eric was that he was as surprised as anybody when the FBI came in there. Whether he thought that Mr. Fox was a little squirrely or not, I couldn't say, but he indicated that he didn't even conceive that this sort of thing might be possible, and that he was grateful that the FBI had an informant in this group so that what they were up to could be uncovered and stopped before it went too far.
Yeah. You alluded to the fact that there's still a lot more to be known about the conspirators and about what's outlined in the indictment. What questions are at the top of your mind about these guys?
I think the number one question for us is, how serious are they? How serious were they? We're 3 weeks out from the election. They had indicated that they planned to act before the election. It does seem like they did some sort of training. It does seem like they did some sort of reconnaissance. Again, we're relying on the federal government, and these are just accusations. So I don't think the government is in the business of making things up, but we're going to have a much better feel for this as the case unfolds. But the biggest question I have is, were they going to do this? How close were they to grabbing Governor Whitmer and making off with her and whisking her to Wisconsin for some sort of show trial? I'm concerned about that. And the other question that I have is they've got 13 people so far. They're just starting to talk to them. How many more are we going to have by the time they're done? Because the way it works is when you get grabbed, sometimes you can get a lighter sentence or better treatment if you offer up other people. So if these 13 people know other people who have not come to light yet, do we end up with 26? Do we end up with 39? Do we end up with more? I really want to know how deep this goes and how serious it was.
Yeah, that we do know that one of the alleged conspirators named in the charging documents is a resident out of state. Do you think we're going to see that web expand further geographically?
That's a great question, because Michigan does have a history of disaffected people, sort of, and I call them self-styled militias, because nobody's asked them to do this. They've decided that they are the modern Minutemen who are going to rescue society, because I certainly don't remember mentioning to these guys that we're a little worried that things are going off the rails. But is the person they contacted in Delaware someone they connected with online, or did they link to somebody else? Why were they going to Wisconsin? Was there somebody in Wisconsin who had a facility they thought was safe? Why did they have a meeting in Ohio? Were there people in Ohio who were involved, or did they just want to somehow get outside the boundaries of Michigan? At this point, the Free Press has uncovered quite a bit, but I think by the time we're done, what we know is going to seem minuscule. And I do think that we're going to see more names and more people come into this, because this was a little more sophisticated than a bunch of geeks getting online and saying, hey, why don't we blow something up? Although they did indeed try and blow stuff up, they didn't do too well at it based on what the feds tell us. And I think we can be grateful for that.
M.L. Elric, longtime Michigan journalist. These days you can read his work in the Detroit Free Press. M.L., thank you so much.
Thanks.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A few weeks ago, after 6 months of lockdown, the visiting policy at Michigan's long-term care facilities finally eased up a bit. The state health department decided that it would allow outdoor visits. Now, this was huge news for people separated from their families because of their residence in rehab centers or assisted living facilities. Michigan Radio's Will Callen has been talking with families and with facility administrators about the new policy, and he joins us now. Hey, Will.
Hey, April.
So what kind of visits are possible now? Can you run us through where things stand?
Yeah, so just to give a little bit of context, so on March 13th, 2020, this is when the, you know, what was near total lockdown started. Very few people were allowed inside any long-term care facilities, not just nursing homes. In June, the state health department started allowing visits in situations where a resident, you know, might be nearing the end of their life or needed help with basic activities like eating. And then on September 15th, this is when facilities were allowed to begin holding outdoor visits. You know, of course, there's still plenty of restrictions there. Visitors have to set up an appointment. They have to follow all of the COVID precautions like physical distancing and mask wearing. And if there's been a case detected among residents or staff in the facility in the last 14 days, they cannot hold visits.
Right. Okay. So how have people been reacting to this news? This is something people have been waiting for a really long time.
Yeah. I mean, as you can probably imagine, the reactions have been mixed because, you know, this is a great step in the right direction, but some people feel like it's not quite enough. I spoke to some nursing home administrators in September, and their reaction was, this is so good for our residents, but we wish that it had happened earlier in the summer when the weather was a lot better. And, you know, they're also saying, you know, we feel like we have our infection control procedures down by this point. We can safely handle indoor visits, so please allow us to hold them, because our residents and their family would absolutely love that. And I've heard very similar things from family members. This is a step in the right direction, but it's still not quite enough. And I just want to acknowledge that a lot of the families I spoke with, they understand that there are risks to loosening this visitation policy. But in some ways, that's made the last 7 months emotionally more trying for them, because they're constantly being asked to balance their personal desire to see their family member in the way that they're used to with the public health interest and often are getting a message that the two things are not compatible. I think based on what I've heard from people that there is a balance that we can strike. You know, I've spoken with infection control experts who say that, you know, it's not that we can return to normal, but certainly a more open visiting policy that includes indoor visits is possible.
Will, is the state health department going to loosen up restrictions in other ways?
Well, so the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal agency, they released their own guidance about this on September 17th, which says that facilities should allow indoor visits. It even went so far as to say that facilities that don't allow them without a good reason could be fined. And I asked Michigan's health department about this, and they didn't really give a clear timeline of when they might start considering indoor visits. They said that they're waiting on clarification from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I think they basically just want to see how much flexibility they have in following that guidance. So it's not clear.
All right. It sounds like indoor visits are a possibility, but again, we don't know when they might happen for sure. Is anybody else pushing for a looser policy here?
You know, one of the most active voices for residents and their family members is the Michigan Elder Justice Initiative. Allison Herschel, she's the managing attorney there, and she says that they get calls about the visitation policy every single day.
We have children talking about never seeing their parents again. We have many residents who've suffered real consequences like losing weight and becoming more depressed and more disoriented because they don't have the regular visits of the family members that they had come to depend on.
So Herschel says that they're calling the health department every day to urge them to loosen these restrictions. But so far, they've been kind of frustrated in those attempts. And she wanted me to know when I spoke to her about this that the health department officials recognize this tension between infection control and humanitarian concerns with residents' mental health, but it just seems like so far in that balance, they've given a little bit more weight to the infection control. And so we're just going to have to wait and see what happens with those indoor visits.
Michigan Radio's Will Callen. Will, thanks for looking into this for us.
Yeah, thanks, April.
Of course, the rules that Will just outlined for us impact not just residents, but also family and friends, everyone who, before the pandemic, was used to popping in and out all the time, bringing people snacks, helping out with chores in their rooms, or just talking. We're joined now by Jane Ogden. She lives in East China, Michigan, and she's got a story to share about this. Jane, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I understand that your dad lives in an assisted living facility. Can you tell us a little bit more about your situation and about your dad?
He has been living in a facility locally since last June. He has dementia, and the reason that he's in the facility is because I just couldn't manage his care anymore at home. In May of last year, he had an emergency pacemaker surgery, and he really, really freaked out at the hospital.
Yeah, it's common for people who have the condition to undergo a decline after a big surgery like that.
Absolutely. Well, this was even before the surgery happened. He didn't know why he needed to have it, and he was really argumentative with the cardiologist that, you know, said that he needed to have the surgery or that he would die. And he wanted to get a second opinion. And he said that the hospital was crap and all of the, you know, staff was crap, and he wouldn't send his worst enemy to this hospital. And he would just try to do everything to get out of the surgery. And he started sundowning.
For those who may not be familiar, sundowning is something that doctors talk about with people who have dementia. At the end of the day, it's very common for them to become less coherent and even more confused than they would normally be. So just a little explainer for those who may not have heard that term before.
Right. Both of the cardiologists said that he would need 24-hour, 7-day-a-week care, and that realization was super overwhelming to me, and they brought in social workers for me to work with to try to find some kind of resolution that would work for my dad and for our family. And so they, you know, did the surgery, and he was in the hospital for about a week, and they sent him to rehab at a facility right by my house. And I chose that one because we live in a semi-rural area, and it was close, and it's filled with staff that are local, and it's filled with family members that are local to our community. So I thought that there would be a lot of connection and kind of, you know, helping each other like we do here in our little small town community.
Sure. There are always a lot of considerations in a situation like that, but just having some physical proximity must have seemed like the best solution for the time.
Absolutely.
So when was the last time you saw your dad?
So the last time I saw my dad was in March before the lockdown began. That was the last time that I was able to take my dad out to see him. That's what I should say.
Yeah.
I saw him recently outside. They just lifted the, you know, the visitation to allow for outside visits. So I called up the facility, and the 15th of September was when they, you know, allowed the restrictions to be lifted according to the governor, but they weren't ready for that at this facility. So I scheduled an appointment. Well, they called me and I scheduled an appointment to come and visit my dad outside. And that was last week. And he was actually the first outside visit that was allowed.
When you were separated from him all those months from March until September, what were some of the ways that you tried to connect with him and show him that you were looking out for him?
Through phone calls. Basically, that's about it. You know, that's all we could do. I went and had a few window visits with him. But it was really confusing, and the windows are all locked down, and you can only talk through the window. They didn't have any kind of phone, you know, communication set up. Mm-hmm. So I was, you know, trying to hear him. So I got my ear plastered to the sash of the window where there a little bit of air goes through, and talked with him that way.
Yeah.
But it was really hard. You know, you can't really communicate at all, and he doesn't really understand what's going on in terms of why there's so many restrictions.
I mean, talking on the phone with dementia patients can be difficult even under the best of circumstances. So I can imagine it must have been really tough trying to show love and carry on a conversation through a window pane.
You know, I had to keep saying, "Dad, I can't see you right now. They won't allow it. You know, there's a terrible virus going around, and they want you to be safe, and we want you to be safe." And you know, then that I'd get, "Well, why can't you come? When are you going to come pick me up?" You know, and then I have to explain again, there's a terrible virus going around and everybody is locked down, and, you know, we have to just be patient and wait. Just complete repetitive conversations. It's just, it's really difficult.
Tell me about how it went the other day when you went to see him for the first time.
So when I went to see him for the first time, I had to, you know, announce that I was there, and then they, told us to go over to outdoor area that was, you know, fenced in with a iron fence, and they wheeled my dad out. I brought some gifts for him. I brought a shirt and a pair of pants and a warm blanket and a bag of Kit Kat bars, because that's my dad's favorite. I brought a card with a picture of Niagara Falls and some old cars on the front of it.
Mm.
That was where my mom and dad honeymooned when they were first married. So I thought that might lift his spirits or, you know, stimulate some memory. And I wrote in really big letters on the inside of the card so that he could read it, or, you know, as much as he could. He's also got macular degeneration, so his eyesight isn't very good.
Yeah. Jane, you don't have to yes. talk about this if it's too difficult, but did he recognize you?
Yes. Yes. Dementia is really, really weird. I mean, everybody presents differently. And my dad is a very articulate, educated man. And so he's very coherent in a lot of ways. He sounds coherent in a lot of ways. And then he starts saying really nonsensical things. So it's a really hard dynamic when you're dealing with somebody that talks pretty normal, and but the things that he says aren't normal at all.
Jane, when you were visiting him, were you feeling self-conscious about the possibility of infection there? Like whether you know, he might become infected by somebody coming in to visit, or like whether you pose some risk to him?
Not really. I guess at this point, I think that communion with each other is a lot more necessary and significant than any risk that COVID would pose. I think at the very beginning, when everybody was really panicked and freaked out, and it was blasted on the news and on the radio 24 hours a day, we were all pretty scared about it. And I thought that my dad would be as safe as possible in the facility. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there would be less risk being in the facility than there would be outside of the facility. But now that, you know, things have opened up and we've gone back to our lives, I think that just, you know, masking maybe and social distancing is okay, you know, but I think masking and being able to hold my dad's hand or give him a hug or rub his back or even taking him out to lunch and at my home, you know, would be completely fine. My situation, you know, there's a limited time to live, irregardless of COVID, and the risk of COVID is really negligible compared to still having lucidness and coherence and quality time.
Would you say that we've heard that there are still an awful lot of restrictions on visitation. For example, indoor visits will only be allowed in very specific situations. As you're trying to think about the coming months with your dad, what do you think the state should keep in mind as it considers loosening up restrictions further?
Well, right now, they allow essential caregivers sometimes in facilities. And those are family members that can come in and feed their family members if they're not capable of feeding themselves, or, you know, assisting in daily activities that the staff can't manage because they're really understaffed. All of these facilities are so understaffed. And end of life kind of situations where the person is on hospice and only has a very short period of time to live. But my dad isn't one of those people. He still has some life left in him, you know, and as the days progress and his brain malfunctions, there's a really limited time. There's a really, really limited time to be able to share our love and life with our family members. And I wish that the states or the powers that be, whoever, understands that, you know, we have a very limited amount of time with our family members. And it shouldn't be an end of life, at the very end of life issue. It should, you know, we should be able to provide them with loving care and attention and warmth.
Well, Jane Ogden, we really appreciate your taking a second to talk to us about this amid all the other things that you're doing right now.
Thank you so much.
Jane Ogden lives in East China. Coming up, what the Michigan Home Guard, one of the state's largest militia groups, is saying about the men involved in the alleged plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As you heard earlier in the show, we're learning more about the 13 men accused of a terrorist plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer and take over the state capitol. Six men face federal charges, and state prosecutors are going after seven additional men. Almost all of them are from right here in Michigan. Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer spent the weekend chasing down leads about the alleged conspirators, and he joins us now. Hey, Dustin.
Hey, April.
So I know that you've been talking with some people who were involved in the protests at the Capitol in Lansing earlier this year, and other people in militias who might have known or at least recognized the 13 people who were indicted. What have you heard about these guys?
Well, first, that they were there. These 13 guys, a lot of them, were at the Capitol during a number of these protests. I mean, anyone who's watched videos or seen photos has seen these guys. Sometimes, at least one of them, Bill Null, was in the Senate gallery. He's in a photo that one of the state senators shared of people, you know, with these rifles walking around in the Senate gallery. Some of the images we remember of people shouting at Michigan State Police inside the Capitol building. Some of these guys were there. So they've been around, they've been in these groups, and even people who were involved in those protests thought at least some of these guys were out there, even for them, a little too far out there. I talked to one person named Tom Norton. He was a former Republican U.S. congressional candidate over here on the west side of the state. He attended at least one of the rallies and met some of these guys. He said he met Adam Fox in particular, who was from Grand Rapids and was he's considered one of the ringleaders of all of this. And Norton says he could tell right away that this guy was off.
I find this interesting that these guys were kicked out of these militias, and the press is trying to say that these militias were part of it when they weren't, when these guys obviously formed their own group, because everybody else is like, you know, you're a little over the top for us. You know, there's crazy and then there's nuts. You can be crazy, but nuts is above crazy.
And these guys were above crazy, at least to Norton. He's not the only one I talked to who felt this way. And it seems that even people on the inside felt this way, because the federal affidavit makes clear that there were at least two informants who basically worked to break up this plot. One came forward to law enforcement after this person heard that some of these plotters were thinking of targeting law enforcement. And one other seemed to at least hang out for much of the planning here and recorded the conversations, copied some of these online text chains. And that formed a lot of the basis for the charges that we saw last week.
Dustin, the affidavit in the federal case says that Adam Fox, who you just mentioned, was kicked out of a militia for all this. Is there anything that you've learned about how that went down?
Yeah, he was in a militia known as the Michigan Home Guard, and I talked to the commanding officer of the Home Guard named Rick Foreman. And the Home Guard has wanted to get out the word to try to distance themselves from this. In fact, they sent me a statement that condemned this plot, and I talked to Rick Foreman, who's the commanding officer, and he said when he met Adam Fox, he said he had rage issues. He said Fox talked about overthrowing the government, and to Foreman, he said that's not what this militia is about at all.
And the reason that he was kicked out of the group is because he couldn't control himself. He was told that he needed to control his attitude and be quiet, or he was going to be booted. And he continued on, so we let him go.
And what Foreman said to me is part of it is this talk that Fox was going around talking to people about overthrowing the government, and that and Foreman said that's not what his militia is about. But what actually got Fox kicked out wasn't the talk of overthrowing the government. It was that Fox was being aggressive with other members on social media and, in fact, threatening other members. And Foreman said that was basically the last straw, and that's when Adam Fox got kicked out. And it seems that Fox then found this other militia, what the Attorney General Dana Nessel says is this other militia that they started calling the Wolverine Watchmen. And that's where a lot of this plot sort of started hatching.
About their social media activities, we know from the U.S. Attorney's Office that many of these men were active on social media and even in some cases worked on their plans on Facebook. It seems like many of their accounts have been taken down at this point. And you also reported last Friday that this large Facebook group started by Second Amendment rights activists has also been taken down. Can you fill us in on that?
Well, this group, Michigan 2A for Sanctuary Counties, that's now been taken down, it had almost 95,000 members as of last week. It started before all this, before the pandemic, before the shutdown, and it was the Second Amendment rights advocates who were trying to organize. And like I said, it's a huge group here with lots of members in the state. But Facebook shut it down. And when I asked Facebook about it, they said it violated Facebook's policy on militarized social movements. And it's not the only group that's been shut down. The Michigan Home Guard, which I mentioned earlier, their Facebook page has been shut down. A lot of individuals who had been involved in this, some of the founders of the Michigan 2A for Sanctuary County's Facebook group, their Facebook's accounts have been shut down. So Facebook has been really active, even since the charges have come out, in shutting down accounts of people and groups who are affiliated.
The men who've been charged were all pretty active online generally, not just on social media. They were at the rallies and the protests that we saw. How have you started thinking about the difference between people who were conspirators and other folks who say they're just out there expressing a political view and exercising their right to protest?
That is a really difficult question for anyone from the outside to assess. Of course, some of the people who were around those protests and knew these guys have been distancing themselves from them and saying, look, these guys are not at all what we're about. You know, we've criticized the governor, but this is crazy. You know, as we heard Tom Norton say, there's a difference between nuts and crazy, and this is maybe nuts. But to anyone else, it can be difficult to tell the difference between someone carrying a sign that says something very violent about the governor and someone who's actually formulating a plan. And actually, even from the inside, it can be difficult. When I talked to Rick Foreman, you know, he said, Adam Fox, yes, I knew he was crazy. But there's two other guys who were charged named Mike Null and Bill Null. And they're, you know, very visible in a lot of the photos. They were out. They did interviews. There, and a lot of reporters talked to them, particularly Bill Null. And to Rick Foreman, at least, he didn't know that these guys would be involved in something like this. And here's what he told me.
I was really surprised to see them in this because I have interactions with MLM and they never struck me as that type of person. It shocked me.
MLM, that was a militia. It's known as the Michigan Liberty Militia. That's where Bill Null and Mike Null were most involved in that militia. But if a guy like Rick Foreman, who's there and who, you know, standing right beside these guys, doesn't know that they're involved in something like this, then, you know, how can the rest of us know?
Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer, you can read his reporting on the shutdown of the Second Amendment Facebook group and other stories that he's been reporting around the alleged kidnapping plot at MichiganRadio.org. Dustin, thanks a lot.
Thanks, April.
The men accused of the terrorist plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer were members of militia groups, including one called the Wolverine Watchmen. There's a good chance that the community where you live is a place where militias are active. You may know people who are active in them. And we've been thinking a lot about what Dustin just said, that people in militias do say there's a difference between the men who were indicted and militias more generally. Joellen Vineyard is a historian and professor emeritus at Eastern Michigan University, and she has spent years researching militias and their role in Michigan's public life. She's the author of the book, Right in Michigan's Grassroots, From the KKK to the Michigan Militia. Joellen Vineyard, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
People who are just turning their attention to the militia movement in Michigan may not know that the state has a history with these kinds of groups here. Will you tell us where they came from?
Well, these groups are independent and reflect the times in which they live. We've had active right-wing groups from across the 20th century. At the same time, on the other side, we've had reform groups. We've had a very solid history of reform movements in Michigan. So Michigan is not a microcosm of the United States. In many ways, it has its own concerns and its own economy that helps give rise to these.
Right. Well, how did Michigan become such a hot spot of militia groups?
The militia, as we know it, and more recently, the militia has dated from the middle 90s, when people were gathering and were concerned about such things as Ruby Ridge and Waco. I really believe that these overriding national concerns do provide a tie to them. But people who join militia often have their own more localized concerns, too. It's things that bother them in their own backyards.
Militia is a pretty broad term. And as you mentioned, there are a number of different militias across the state. What do all these groups have in common?
Well, among other things, they're all fearful of government authority being abused. They all believe in the Second Amendment, and they all believe, for the most part, that they are helping America. They think that they are a force behind democracy, and that some citizens have been duped into believing leaders who have not been treating them fairly or honestly.
Are there some connections between some of the militias today and right-wing hate groups of the past, like the Ku Klux Klan?
Just very tenuous connections, really, in terms of the concerns that they have about the government. The Ku Klux Klan in the 20s wanted to help the government, that they felt the government wasn't being respected sufficiently. They wanted to help it. These groups today are fearful of the government. They believe that it's gotten too much power, that they are too involved in the world order. So there are some connections. Mostly it's people, ordinary Americans, who are afraid of what's happening in the society and more in general, and they think they should stand up and take responsibility.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Joellen Vineyard. She's professor emeritus at Eastern Michigan University and a historian who has researched militias and their role in Michigan. Joellen, can you trace back for us when the term militia came into use by right-wing and anti-government groups, and maybe sort of why they chose that term?
They chose the term because it gives them, I think, a certain constitutional legitimacy. But it really is not a good term to describe all of these groups across the time. Militias are, you know, they're in the Second Amendment. And so that's where they find some constitutional legitimacy.
Right. How connected are these groups to particular political movements?
Well, at certain times, they're very connected. Many of the right-wing groups across the 20th century in Michigan have been Republican. Not all, but many of them have been connected with the Republican Party, or they would say the Libertarian Party. Some of them right now do not connect themselves as Republicans, but more commonly that's the case.
How effective would you say the militias have been in influencing broader politics in the state?
That's the trouble. They're very influential, and more importantly, perhaps, it's the broader population that gives rise to the militia, because they are not just a group of kooks and camouflage, but they represent ideas and attitudes that the public more generally has come to hold. You know, in the 90s, people were concerned in Michigan about such things as NAFTA. They were worried about the Brady Bill, and they were worried about a variety of concerns that the militia then picks up and carries on to an extreme in many cases.
Yeah. There's been a lot of conversation in recent days about the distinction between a militia, what makes a militia, and what makes a terrorist group. How do you make that distinction?
Well, they are very different. The editor of the Free Press yesterday had a column on the fact that we should not be calling these recent people militia. They're a terrorist group. They've organized themselves to create terror and to take extreme measures against, in this case, the governor.
Yeah. What would you say these groups have to offer the men and sometimes the women who get involved in them?
A sense that they're doing something, that they aren't just sitting by and letting the government make all the decisions. They believe they're responsible American citizens, many of them. This group most recently believed that they were reflecting a broader concern that the governor had been too strict in enforcing measures to combat the virus.
Were you surprised when you heard the news of the alleged plot last week?
Yes. Yes, I was. You know, it apparently had been in the planning for quite a long time. This group has been connecting with others beyond the state. The internet has given rise to the militia strength or the different terrorist groups' strength. They can organize themselves with little attention. So, yes, I really was surprised. That's a very drastic action.
It sounds like in your conversations with people who have been in militias that they reflect a need to respond to the times that they live in. And it feels like, if nothing else, this particular incident is something that a lot of other people are going to respond to, both within law enforcement and in politics. Do you see any reason to believe that the militia movement might change because of what's played out in Michigan this year?
Well, possibly, although there is no such thing as a Michigan militia. It's a bunch of groups, basically, that are organized locally. They have never been able to form themselves into a unified Michigan militia. And will they be able to influence the public? Possibly, yes. The middle shifts toward the left or the right, depending on the times and what's going on. So it's really hard to know. I think that this is such an extreme action that people will be not in favor of kidnapping and the governor and putting her on trial for treason.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you wish was more widely understood about the various militias that maybe are active in Michigan right now?
Well, I wish people understood that these are not all the same, the militias. There are different concerns of the small group that form them. And so some of them are, like this last group, are really more legitimately terrorists. Others of them are just simply trying to do what they believe is necessary to restore basic democratic rights. They've been taught in school about the necessity of Americans to stand up and take responsibility, and that's what many of them think they're doing.
Is there anything else that you think is important to understand about the ecosystem that the militias operate in?
I think it's important that we realize how much of this is connected with the rhetoric right now of the president. He has given people the license to feel that they should do something about these problems. You know, liberate Michigan, he said. I think that the fear of the press, the effort to downgrade and say everything is fake news is a problem. I don't think people are listening enough and carefully enough to facts and, you know, the real situation that's going on.
Joellen Vineyard is professor emeritus at Eastern Michigan University and author of Right in Michigan's Grassroots, From the KKK to the Michigan Militia. Joellen, thanks for coming and talking to us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.